Chapter 14. Trade by the United States finds himself impressed by the work of the missionaries, who have converted cannibals to Christians, and gives picturesque bits of the life and scenery. I was then dominated chiefly by French and English, though the American interests were by no means small. Extract from letter number 4. Cap. Fitch said, "Here's the king. That's him in the buggy. I know him as far as I can see him." I had never seen a king, and I naturally took out a notebook and put him down: colon tall, slender, dark, full bearded, green frock coat, with lapels and collar be ordered with gold band an inch wide, plug hat, broad gold band around it, royal costume looks too much like livery, this man is not as fleshy as I thought he was. I had just got these notes when Cap Fitch discovered that he'd got hold of the wrong king, or rather, that he'd got hold of the king's driver, or a carriage driver of one of the nobility. The king wasn't present at all. It was a great disappointment to me. I heard afterwards that the comfortable, easy-going king, Kamehameha V, had been seen sitting on a barrel on the wharf, the day before, fishing. But there was no consolation in that. That did not restore me my lost king. This has something of the flavor of the man we were to know later, the quaint, gentle resignation to disappointment which is one of the finest touches in his humor. Further on he says, colon, I had not shaved since I left San Francisco. As soon as I got ashore I hunted up a striped pole, and shortly found one. I always had a yearning to be a king. This may never be, I suppose, but, at any rate, it will always be a satisfaction to me to know that, if I am not a king, I am the next thing to it. I have been shaved by the king's barber. Honolulu was a place of cats. He saw cats of every shade and variety. He says, colon, I saw cats, tomcats, Marianne cats, bobtailed cats, blind cats, one-eyed cats, wall-eyed cats, cross-eyed cats, gray cats, black cats, white cats, yellow cats, striped cats, spotted cats, tame cats, wild cats, singed cats, individual cats, groups of cats, platoons of cats, companies of cats, armies of cats, multitudes of cats, millions of cats, and all of them sleek, fat, and lazy, and sound asleep. Which illustrates another characteristic of the humor we were to know later, the humor of grotesque exaggeration, in which he was always strong. He found the islands during his periods of inaction conducive to indolence. If I were not so fond of looking into the rich mass of green leaves, he says, that sway the stately tamarind right before my door, I would idle less, and write more, I think. The Union made good use of his letters. Sometimes it printed them on the front page. Evidently they were popular from the beginning. The Union was a fine, handsome paper, beautiful in its minute typography, and in its press work, more beautiful than most papers of today, with their machine set type, their vulgar illustrations, and their chain lightning presses. A few more extracts. The only cigars here are those trifling, insipid, tasteless, flavorless things they call Manilas, 10 for 25 cents, and it would take 1,000 of them to be worth half the money. After you have smoked about $35 worth of them in the forenoon, you feel nothing but a desperate yearning to go out somewhere and take a smoke. Aptons and ministers form about half the population. The third fourth is composed of Kanakas and mercantile foreigners and their families. The final fourth is made up of high officers of the Hawaiian government, and there are just about enough cats to go round. In number 6, April the 2D, he says, colon, an excursion to Diamond Head and the King's Coconut Grove was planned today at 4:30 p.m. The party to consist of half a dozen gentlemen and three ladies. They all started at the appointed hour except myself. Somebody remarked that it was 5:20, and that woke me up. It was a fortunate circumstance that Cap Phillips was there with his turnout, apostrophe as he calls his top buggy that Cap Cook brought here in 1778, and a horse that was here when Cap Cook came. This bit has something the savor of his subsequent work, but, as a rule, the humor compares poorly with that which was to come later. In number 7 he speaks of the natives singing American songs not always to his comfort. Arching Through Georgia was one of their favorite airs. He says, colon, if it had been all the same to Gen. Sherman, I wish he had gone around by the way of the Gulf of Mexico, instead of marching through Georgia. Letters nos. 8, 9, and 10 were not of special importance. In number 10 he gives some advice to San Francisco, as to the treatment of whalers. He says, if I were going to advise San Francisco, as to the best strategy, to employ in order to secure the whaling trade, I should say, cripple your facilities for owing sea captains on any pretense that sailors can trump up, and show the whaler a little more consideration when he is in port. In number 11, May 24th, he tells of a trip to the Kali Valley and through historic points. At one place he looked from a precipice over which old Kamehameha I drove the army of Oahu 3/4 of a century before. The vegetation and glory of the tropics attracted him. In one open spot a vine of a species unknown had taken possession of 2 tall dead stumps, and wound around and about them, and swung out from their tops, and twined their meeting tendrils together into a faultless arch. Man, with all his art, could not improve upon its symmetry. He saw Sam Brannan's palace, the bungalow, built by one Shillaber of San Francisco at a cost of from $30,000 to $40,000. In its day it had outshone its regal neighbor, the palace of the king, but had fallen to decay, after passing into Brannan's hands, and had become a picturesque Theban ruin by the time of Mark Twain's visit. In number 12, June 20th, written May 23d, he tells of the Hawaiian legislature, and of his trip to the island of Maui, where, as he says, he never spent so pleasant a month before, or bade any place goodbye so regretfully. In number 13 he continues the legislature, and gives this picture of Minister Harris, colon, he is 6 feet high, bony and rather slender, long, ungainly arms, stands so straight he leans back a little, has small side whiskers, his head long, up and down. He has no command of language or ideas, oratorial show and pretense, a big washing, and a small hangout, weak, insipid, and a damn fool in general. In number 14, June 22d, published July 16th, he tells of the death and burial ceremonies of the Princess Victoria K.K., and, what was to be of more importance to him, of the arrival of Anson Burlingame, U.S. Minister to China, and General Van Valkenburg, U.S. Minister to Japan. They were to stay 10 or 14 days, he said, but an effort would be made to have them stay over July 4th. Speaking of Burlingame, colon, Burlingame is a man who could be esteemed, respected, and popular anywhere, no matter whether he was among Christians or cannibals. Then, in the same letter, comes the great incident. Letter arrived here yesterday, giving a meager account of the arrival, on the island of Hawaii, of 19 poor, starving wretches, who had been buffeting a stormy sea, in an open boat, for 43 days. Their ship, the Hornet, from New York, with a quantity of kerosene on board, had taken fire and burned in lat. 2D north, and long. 35D west. When they had been entirely out of provisions for a day or two, and the cravings of hunger become insufferable, they yielded to the shipwrecked mariner's fearful and awful alternative, and solemnly drew lots to determine who of their number should die, to furnish food for his comrades. And then the morning mists lifted, and they saw land. They are being cared for at Sanpaho, not yet corroborated. The Hornet disaster was fully told in his letter of June 27th. The survivors were brought to Honolulu, and with the assistance of the Burlingame Party, Clemens, laid up with saddle boils, was carried on a stretcher to the hospital, where, aided by Burlingame, he interviewed the shipwrecked men, securing material for the most important piece of serious writing he had thus far performed. Letter number 15 to the Union of date June 25 occupied the most of the first page in the issue of July 19. It was a detailed account of the sufferings of officers and crew, as given by the third officer and members of the crew. From letter No. 15. In the postscript of a letter which I wrote 2 or 3 days ago, and sent by the ship Ivanki, I gave you the substance of a letter received here from Hilo, by Walker Allen and Company, informing them that a boat, containing 15 men in a helpless and starving condition, had drifted ashore at Sanpo'o, island of Hawaii, and that they had belonged to the clipper ship Ornate Cap. Mitchell, master, had been afloat since the burning of that vessel, about 100 miles north of the equator, on the 3rd of May, 43 days. The third mate, and 10 of the seamen have arrived here, and are now in the hospital. Cap. Mitchell, one seaman named Antonio Passon, and two passengers, Samuel and Henry Ferguson, of New York City, 18 and 28 years, are still at Hilo, but are expected here within a week. In the captain's modest epitome of the terrible romance, you detect the fine old hero through it. It reads like Grant. Here follows the whole terrible narrative, which has since been published in more substantial form, and has been recognized as literature. It occupied 3.5 columns on the front page of the Union, and, of course, constituted a great beat for that paper, a fact which they appreciated to the extent of $100 the column upon the writer's return from the islands. In letters Nos. 14 and 15. He gives further particulars of the month of mourning for the princess, and funeral ceremonials. He refers to Burlingame, who was still in the islands. The remaining letters are unimportant. The Hawaiian episode in Mark Twain's life was one of those spots that seemed to him always filled with sunlight. From beginning to end it had been a long luminous dream. In the next letter, written on the homeward bound ship, becalmed under a cloudless sky, we realize the fitting end of the experience. To Mrs. Jane Clemens and Mrs. Moffat, in St. Louis. On board ship Smyrniot, at sea, July 30, 1866. Dear mother and sister, I write now, because I must go hard at work, as soon as I get to San Francisco, and then I shall have no time for other things, though truth to say I have nothing now, to write which will be calculated to interest you much. We left the Sandwich Islands 8 or 10 days or 12 days ago, I don't know which. I have been so hard at work until today, at least part of each day, that the time has slipped away almost unnoticed. The first few days we came at a whooping gait, being in the latitude of the northeast trades, but we soon ran out of them. We used them, as long as they lasted, hundreds of miles, and came dead straight north until exactly abreast of San Francisco, precisely straight west of the city in a B-line, but a long B-line, as we were about 2,000 miles at sea. Consequently, we are not 100 yards nearer San Francisco than you are. And here we lie becalmed on a glassy sea, we do not move an inch, we throw banana and orange peel overboard, and it lies still on the water by the vessel's side. Sometimes the ocean is as dead level as the Mississippi River, and glitters glassily, as if polished, but usually, of course, no matter how calm the weather is, we roll and surge over the grand ground swell. We amuse ourselves tying pieces of tin to the ship's log, and sinking them to see how far we can distinguish them underwater. 86 feet was the deepest we could see a small piece of tin, but a white plate would show about as far down as the steeple of Dr. Bullard's church would reach, I guess. The sea is very dark and blue here. Ever since we got becalmed, 5 days, I have been copying the diary of one of the young Fergusons, the two boys who starved and suffered, with 13 others, in an open boat at sea for 43 days. Lately, after their ship, the Ornith was burned on the equator. Both these boys and Captain Mitchell are passengers with us. I am copying the diary to publish in Harper's Magazine if I have time to fix it up properly when I get to San Francisco. I suppose, from present appearances, light winds and calms, that we shall be 2 or 3 weeks at sea yet, and I hope so. I am in no hurry to go to work. Sunday morning, August 6. This is rather slow. We still drift along at intervals a spanking breeze, and then drift again, hardly move for half a day. But I enjoy it. We have such snowy moonlight, and such gorgeous sunsets. And the ship is so easy even in a gale. She rolls very little, compared to other vessels, and in this calm we could dance on deck, if we chose. You can walk a crack, so steady is she. Very different from the Ajax. My trunk used to get loose in the stateroom, and rip and tear around the place, as if it had life in it, and I always had to take my clothes off in bed, because I could not stand up and do it. There is a ship in sight, the first object we have seen since we left Honolulu. We are still 1,300 or 1,400 miles from land, and so anything like this that varies the vast solitude of the ocean makes all hands light-hearted and cheerful. We think the ship is the Amit, which left Honolulu several hours before we did. She is about 12 miles away, and so we cannot see her hull, but the sailors think it is the Comet, because of some peculiarity about her fore top gallant sails. We have watched her all the forenoon. Afternoon we had preaching on the quarter deck by Rev. Mr. Rising, of Virginia City, old friend of mine, spread a flag on the booby hatch, which made a very good pulpit, and then ranged the chairs on either side against the bulwarks. Last Sunday we had the shadow of the mainsail, but today we were on the opposite tack, close hauled, and at the sun. I am leader of the choir on this ship, and a sorry let it is. I hope they will have a better opinion of our music in heaven than I have down here. If they don't, a thunderbolt will come down and knock the vessel endways. The other ship is the Comet. She is right abreast 3 miles away, sailing on our course, both of us in a dead calm. With the glasses we can see what we take to be men and women on her decks. I am well acquainted with nearly all her passengers, and being so close seems right sociable. Monday 7, I had just gone to bed a little after midnight, when the 2D mate came, and roused up the captain and said, "The Comet has come round, and is standing away on the other tack." I went up immediately, and so did all our passengers, without waiting to dress men, women, and children. There was a perceptible breeze. Pretty soon the other ship swept down upon us with all her sails set, and made a fine show in the luminous starlight. She passed within 100 yards of us, so we could faintly see persons on her decks. We had 2 minutes' chat with each other, through the medium of hoarse shouting, and then she bore away to windward. In the morning she was only a little black peck standing out of the glassy sea in the distant horizon, an almost invisible mark in the bright sky. Dead calm. So the ships have stood, all day long, have not moved 100 yards. August 8, the calm continues. Magnificent weather. The gentlemen have all turned boys. They play boyish games on the poop and quarter deck. For instance, they lay a knife on the fife rail of the mainmast, stand off 3 steps, shut one eye, walk up and strike at it with the forefinger. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.